Well, hello and welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book In Broken Water by Adlard Coles. We're making our way through the second chapter, and this is the second part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month, you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Chapter 2 continued. Presently, a fishing boat crossed our course and we hailed her. Wonder of wonders, she was a foreigner, and her crew could not understand us. They gathered eventually that we wanted the Nord Hinder and waved us a vague direction, which was about on our original course. At length, to our relief, a speck broke over the horizon, and at midday, in blazing sun, we ran slowly past the lightship before a gentle westerly breeze. We passed close enough to ask the time, which question brought all her crew on deck, who pressed us with questions in broken English. The next lightship was the Mars, 45 miles distant, for which a course was set. I was not confident that the good weather would last, for in the afternoon the glass was falling, and by 4 p.m. it had dropped 0.2 to 30.4 inches. The wind slowly freshened all evening and during the night, until early in the cold morning there was a crash, and our little dinghy, which we carried on the lee side of our deck jammed on the cabin top and the rail, fell overboard, carrying with it the hurricane lamp. All hands on deck! Buster took the helm and let Annette sail slowly close to the wind, whilst Dunsterville and I hauled the boat back into its right position and lashed it down. Two turns were taken in the reefing gear, and then Annette was once again on her proper course. At 2:30 a.m. the yacht was off the Mars lightship, making splendid progress but plunging in a rising sea. It was cold and wet, and we were tired and not in a frame of mind to anticipate the romance of seeing land after 48 hours at sea. I had to take a few more turns in the reefing gear and presently reef right down, as it was then blowing half a gale and a dirty sea was getting up. To make things worse, we had the tide against us, and we could lay close hauled on the port tack only as far as Scheveningen, after which the wind would be a dead noser up the Dutch coast. Land ho! There it lay, a low grey streak on the starboard bow. As the yacht sailed closer, occasional spires and towers appeared, and I consulted the North Sea pilot in a vain endeavour to identify the coast. But it did not help, for sand dunes, churches and towers abound along the coast of Holland. So on we sailed, gradually overhauling a large catch also northward bound. Presently we closed with a town and also came near to the catch. She looked like a pilot boat, so I ran up under her lee, lowered the peak of the mainsail, checked off the sheets and entered into conversation. Her crew could not understand a word of English, but with difficulty I made them understand a pilot was wanted for IJmuiden. They shouted, "5 pond." "1 pound," I shouted back, but they shook their heads. So we hauled in our sheets, hoisted the peak again, and soon left them behind. We had gleaned one useful bit of information from the Dutchman, however, and that was that we were off Scheveningen. That meant that IJmuiden was about 25 miles to the north-northwest. The wind had hardened to half a gale, and we did not fancy beating to windward against wind and tide. So we rounded and ran south along the low coast of the Hook of Holland. At that hour, 8:30 a.m, our spirits were at a low ebb. It had been wet driving the yacht to windward in a rough sea, wet on deck from spray and wet below from deck or cabin top leaks. The north wind was very cold, and we were chilled to the bone. The visibility was extremely poor, the coast unknown, and we felt by no means certain of identifying the Hook of Holland. If we missed this port, we should probably get mixed up with the sands lying to the south. However, our anxiety was unnecessary, for the Hook of Holland proved easy to identify by its long breakwaters. At 10:30, we entered the harbour. We brought up alongside a motorboat at Bergershaven on the north side of the river. We had made our first passage and were safely in our first foreign port. Chapter 3. Through Holland. It was raining hard, and as we were pretty tired, we were glad of the help of two friendly Dutchmen off the motorboat in furling our sails, adjusting our warps and coiling our halyards. In particular, we appreciated their gin and cigars, which gave us a rosier view of life. When in dry clothes, we wandered up to a little hotel and had our first meal in Holland, which we enjoyed very much, especially as we had eaten nothing but ship's biscuits for 24 hours. At the beginning of the cruise, before we got our sea legs, we were not seasick, but at the same time, we were not quite fit, so that the motion of the little yacht in the large swell was sufficient to spoil the appetite for anything but dry biscuits. The next morning, we did a little exploring. There is not much to see at the Hook. 2 or 3 clean, brick-paved roads running between cottages, 2 windmills and a water tower can hardly be described as impressive. We strolled down to the sea. It was blowing hard and the combers were foaming at the breakwater and along the shore. The hooded straw chairs, a feature of Dutch seaside resorts, looked forlorn, standing empty under the windswept sand dunes. The afternoon was spent in Rotterdam. We did not find the town interesting, and after having a bath, we returned to the Hook. The train journey had been the best part of our entertainment. The line runs along the canal, past fields and quaint villages and harbours, ships and windmills. It is monotonous scenery, but it is Dutch and was new to us. Next day, we had an uneventful sail along the sandy coast to IJmuiden, where we tied up alongside the quay to wait our turn to go through the locks into the North Sea Canal. The sight of our ensign was a signal for a crowd to gather, sailors, boys, quayside spitters and other idlers. The small boys made a lot of noise and were a bit of a nuisance, and we were soon to learn that Dutch children are high-spirited and mischievous. Although Dutchmen are reputed to be a stolid race, they breed children who are quite the reverse. In France, it is the opposite. The Latin temperament of the adults is not reflected in the children, who are quiet and almost invariably polite. However, several Dutchmen who could speak English elbowed their way to the front and subdued the youthful exuberance. One wanted to pilot us to Amsterdam, one wanted to pilot us anywhere, and the other wanted to sell us vegetables. We left the boat in charge of the Amsterdam pilot and went ashore for a meal with the world pilot and the greengrocer. The latter was got rid of by buying a few provisions, and the former remained with us for 3 days, piloting us across the Zuider Zee. A pilot was not required, but he was useful as interpreter, and also as he had Dutch charts, the English ones we had brought being unsuitable for inland waters. At 9 a.m. next morning, our pilot arrived on board armed with a large kit bag and an even larger chart. We had scarcely started breakfast, so that some delay ensued before we were actually underway. Our route lay along the North Sea Canal to Amsterdam, and we found our first experience of canal work interesting. Annette was in a two-way stream of shipping, ships of all sizes and many types. Most striking were the big barges with brightly coloured hulls and bluff bows, looking picturesque with the sun on their tanned sails. A fleet of pole-masted fishing boats with noisy engines jogged lustily past in single file. They were returning to Urk, a small island in the middle of the Zuider Zee. The fishermen of Urk are a type of their own, and they looked tough and dour. One helmsman in particular, not the one shown in the photograph, had a lined, wizened face which made him look as old as Adam. He was clothed in a dirty canvas shirt and wide pantaloons with black stockings disappearing into huge clogs. On his head he wore a kind of woolen Turkish fez, and he sat motionless and expressionless on his tiller, staring fixedly ahead, apparently oblivious of the world outside. Our progress, with a fresh following wind, was quick, and we were soon near the great port of Amsterdam. We passed 2 bridges on the way, and our pilot informed us he thought we could sail under both safely. But when we were a few yards from the first, I saw we should lose our mast, and I had just time to round up to avoid the accident. We waited 20 minutes until it opened, and then ran through without mishap. Our pilot said he was really quite sure we could get under the second bridge. A yacht twice our size could get through, he swore. So at it we went. But I must confess I had grave misgivings as I saw the truck of our mast fast closing with that great steel span above, when we got under with what appeared a foot to spare. In Amsterdam at last. The river was a scene of intense activity, and a good deal of responsibility fell on the helmsman. Ships of all sorts were passing, ferries, tugs, passenger steamers, barges, yachts, cargo boats, motor boats, and the Urk fishermen. It was not long before we altered course to cross the river, and taking a channel on our port hand, we warped our way into the twisted entrance of the Yacht Basin. In the afternoon, we went to have a look around Amsterdam, but had not much time to see much. Country interested us more than towns, so a description of Amsterdam must be left to guidebooks. The principal impression it left on me was that it was a city of waterways, split up and surrounded by canals. Every turn gives the traveller a surprise. He may perhaps be walking along a crowded main street in a busy shopping centre and take a turning off. In a minute, the aspect is perfectly different. Narrow roads and gloomy canals, walls wet with damp, and an occasional dirty barge propelled by lusty men heaving on great poles. The next day began badly. At 8 o'clock we got underway and found it difficult to get out of harbour against a light and uncertain headwind, as the channel had two right-angled corners and was narrow. The right thing to do was either to tow Annette out with a dinghy or to warp her out. Our pilot, however, thought he knew better, and I was weak enough to let him have his way and sail out. He really upset things, and a crowd collected to watch, for Annette, with her large headsail, required very careful handling, and all my steering was upset by the well-meant efforts of our officious sailor. When coming about, he would lunge at the wall with the boat hook, swinging the yacht's head round so much that it was almost necessary to wear ship. We got out of harbour safely, but in a disgustingly slovenly manner, and I did not recover my temper until we were at the Zuider Zee locks. The big ship sailor is not necessarily of any use on small yachts. Every boat needs knowing and has peculiarities of her own, and a man is foolish to assume that he can sail a dinghy because he can handle a liner, and, of course, vice versa. The locks having been negotiated, we found ourselves in company with a very smart yacht, three fishing boats and a barge. The fishing boats, with their motors, soon left us, and we in turn left the yacht behind, in spite of her big spread of canvas and large spinnaker. The barge gave us a good race, and I forget now who won, but she certainly kept us company a long way past Marken, an island which is somewhat of a showpiece for tourists, which we left to port. There is not much to be seen in the Zuider Zee, as the shores are so low as to be almost out of sight even when only a mile distant. The shipping, however, gave us some entertainment, and we never tired of looking at the gaily decorated barges as brightly painted as a Noah's Ark. These were very spick and span, very clean and polished, with curtains and flower pots in the windows of the cabin. These big ships were handled by the skipper and his wife and perhaps a boy. They looked efficient, but later we came across a vessel which made us rub our eyes. She was a barge carrying an immense haystack amidships, which looked as if it had been dumped aboard, the ends hanging over each side of the hull. The haystack was as high as our mast, and as it completely obstructed the view from aft, a staging had been rigged on the stern so that the helmsman could see over the top to steer, and plenty of steering she must have required with that tremendous load. The wind fell light, so it was not until 3 p.m. that we lay becalmed off that wonderful old place, Enkhuizen. An old town lay before us, with towers and spires rising above the little square-windowed cottages surrounding them. Red roofs and brown sails were the predominant features. Presently the wind freshened hard from the south, and we slipped past with a host of little fishing boats, high-bowed with huge leeboards like wings, and the inevitable ribbons of blue bunting streaming out from their pole masts. The glass was falling, and the wind hardening all the time, so it was not long before we had to close reef. The Zuider Zee is so shallow that a vile sea gets up quickly. We were soon wet through, miserably cold and very uncomfortable, four men on board being a crowd. It came on to rain, and visibility became bad. Our pilot felt sick, and as he could not see any of the boys he expected, he felt anxious too. Presently we saw a barge ahead, and soon discovered our genial pilot was following her. Hitherto he had looked miserable, but the sight of this guiding angel transformed his utter depression to noisy self-assertiveness. At last a buoy appeared, and we knew where we were, and passed through a narrow channel between sands, and at length got into Harlingden at 8 p.m. Crowds of Dutchmen at once gathered on the wharf to see that somewhat rare sight of so small an English yacht. We were tired and wet through, and thought one of them might offer to lend a hand at the pump instead of placidly watching our efforts. However, we had made good 60 miles, and when we went ashore to an inn and sat down to large plates piled with hot meat and vegetables, we took a less jaundiced view of matters, and mildly ragged our pilot who, needless to say, denied he had merely followed the barge and was disgustingly pleased with himself on account of not having wrecked us. The next day was a Sunday, and we were none too happy to learn all bridges would be shut. The morning was spent in walking round the town, which was rather disappointing, for we had expected a picturesque harbour like Enkhuizen, but found nothing of the sort, merely a very ordinary town. In the afternoon, we wandered back to the ship, but found little peace on board, as the two adjacent wharves were packed with people staring at us. We decided we must give them something to stare at, so we boiled some water, and then I lay flat on the deck with my head in a towel while Buster shaved me. This caused laughter from the crowd and howls of pain from me, for the razor was rusty and Buster anything but a barber. After that, we played the gramophone and exchanged hard ship's biscuits for monkey nuts with some of the crowd. Gilbert and Sullivan music on the gramophone was the highlight of the entertainment, and it was funny hearing the Dutchman picking out and trying to imitate such words as paradox. All in all, we gave good value and were tempted to pass the hat round. Monday arrived at last, and we paid off our pilot and gave him our blessings. He was a good fellow, really, and hardly to be blamed for being out of place in such a small boat, where there was hardly room to move. Our route now lay through canals in northern Friesland, which followed the coastline a few miles inland. These would take us some 30 miles to the village of Dockham, after which we would lock through into the North Sea at Dockham Seal, some 8 miles further on. Before leaving Harlingen, we had to pass through the locks, which we did at 10:30 a.m, and started on our way with a nice following breeze. I soon discovered we went way too fast under mainsail, and a net was not under sufficient control for the navigation in these crowded canals. We hoisted the trysail instead, giving her a speed of about 3 knots, and this sail had the advantage of being easily hoisted and lowered, as occasion demanded. The weather was hot, and our tempers very much tired by constant worry of bridges, tugs, and shipping. That day in the canals cost us a lot. It was sunny, and we had everything on deck, and consequently, things went overboard. A basin, a knife, and 2 bowls, the dinghy, also broke adrift again. We passed a village named Franeker, where we stopped to buy some black bread, which proved hard and gritty. Buster put some of it in his pipe, but found it too damp to smoke. In the evening, the wind died away altogether, and we had to tow a net by dinghy into Leeuwarden, the capital town of Friesland, a big place about 15 miles from Harlingen. Our little 8-foot pram dinghy caused quite a sensation there, for the barges have great heavy boats, and our little eggshell evidently gave the Frieslanders a bit of a surprise and considerable amusement. The evening meal and the washing up took a long time, and it was midnight before Buster and I left the ship. It was an eerie experience going ashore in this silent city in the depth of the night. We walked past rows of shuttered windows without meeting a soul. It seemed like a city of the dead. At length we came to a leaning tower, massive and gaunt, the haunt of bats and owls, I should imagine, and then we turned and strolled back through the narrow streets. We were not what might be called early risers, but with a great effort we got up at 7:30 a.m. on Tuesday, and having had breakfast went ashore for water and provisions and to see the town by daylight. Everything was so different from the night before. The canals were alive with ships and men, the streets were busy and cheerful in the bright sunlight. However, we were in a hurry, so at 11 a.m. a net was running through the outskirts of the town. The morning passed without incident, and early in the afternoon we had covered another 15 miles to Dockham. On the canal, we had passed a great number of bridges which opened at the last moment to let us through, when simultaneously a long fishing rod with a wooden shoe would be slung out, in which we were to put 10 or 25 cents as payment. At Dockham, where an elderly woman was operating the bridge failed to open. I had just time to round up, but was unable to avoid running the bowsprit hard into a mooring post. Luckily, no damage was done. After Dockham, a change in the scene was noticeable. The canal seemed cleaner and was lined on either side by rushes, and there were fewer houses and trees. We were passing through agricultural country, intensely cultivated, and the traffic on the canal was comparatively insignificant. At 3:30 p.m. we arrived at Dockham Seal, where we passed through the locks into the North Sea. I was delighted to be in tidal waters again. None of us had really much enjoyed the canals. Navigation, however, was now going to be difficult because we had to sail through the tidal estuary of the Lower Zee and then follow along a shallow winding channel between the sands which obstruct the whole area between the mainland and the Frisian Islands. We were entering the waters we had read about in The Riddle of the Sands, but we had no large-scale charts to help us. When Annette passed through the locks, most of the local population assembled to watch. Among them was a decrepit-looking pilot, whose offer of services I indignantly refused, as even the word pilot was a red rag to a bull. It was unfortunate, therefore, that within 100 yards of leaving the locks, we promptly went aground in full view of the crowd. We did not understand the Dutch method of marking the channel and ran the wrong side of a beacon, with the obvious result. We had hit hard, and it was an ebb tide, so all the usual expedients of kedging and backing the sails and rolling the yacht first one way and then the other failed ignominiously. We went below for a cup of tea, and afterwards Dunsterville and I set out with chart, sounding line and binoculars to survey the channel and learn the system of marking. The yacht had grounded on the top of a mud bank, so was likely to remain there for 10 hours. It looked as though there might possibly not be enough water to float her at the next tide, and accordingly, at low tide, Dunsterville and I jumped into the dinghy, which was aground on the soft mud, and proceeded to dig a channel with the sculls and the bucket so that the yacht could be towed out into deeper water when the tide rose. It was dirty work, and the ship was nearly as dirty as we were when all was ready. There was mud everywhere, on our hands, feet and clothes. The yacht and the dinghy were plastered with it, and our varnished boat hook was black with it. At about 11 p.m. she floated, and after anchoring in the middle of the channel, we retired, thankfully, to bed. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly, and remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you are safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.